Hello to all my fellow 101 History Podcast listeners out there. I hope all of you are doing well, and it's certainly great to be back on the air with you guys. I wasn't sure when I would be back on the air again next. I was hoping to have been on the air last night, but I had some other things that came up. But, you know, all is good. That's just what happens sometimes. But it is great to be back on the air with you guys. And I am going to say this here, that we are really nearing the end to this podcast book topic series on the Battle of Lake Champlain, a brilliant and extraordinary victory. However, before we can get to that epilogue being the ending, we do have to cover some very essential information. But then again, we've covered essential information in pretty much every podcast segment episode per this book topic discussion, as would be expected. But the reason why what we've got to talk about here now in terms of being essential is that we are going to be discussing in a two-part episode series on the treaty. You know, we learned from the previous episode how the news got to Canada, and how the news eventually made it to England about this sudden, I take it back. The news made it into Canada first before it really reached England. The news being of Prevost's, or Sir George Prevost's, downfall. He certainly was at the top of his game, but all of that changed come September 11th, 1814. But perhaps in the days leading up to September 11th, 1814 as well, for a good period of time, Prevost seemed to have had it all. He felt as though the Americans were simply not able to put up a fight against a mighty foe in Goliath, we should say, or being that of the British. But we've come to realize that it was one thing for Prevost's forces to have been defeated, but in the manner in which it happened was even worse. Many in Canada, we learned, dubbed Prevost as being a real wimp. They dubbed him as perhaps the officer whom sold out his country, the man whom really wasn't looking after his own people, being British subjects in Canada. So for George Prevost, he has been sacked. He's been replaced. And of course, he did not know of his replacement until March of 1815, nearly 6 months after the Battle of Lake Champlain in Plattsburgh. If you're on the side of the British, you probably are relieved to know that the Navy has been exonerated of all wrongdoing. Its leadership from within the Army, most notably with Prevost, where the buck stopped and where the buck lies in terms of fault. I can't blame the officers below Prevost for writing letters without mentioning Prevost's name, but expressing disappointment in leadership from the highest position there was. Not just leadership, but how badly exercised the leadership was. You almost have to wonder if any of the officers whom wrote their concerns to the British government, if it had been them whom was in charge, they would not have backed down. They would have allowed for this expedition to go through into by crossing into Plattsburgh once militiamen on the United States side began retreating and making their way back to the village settlement of Salmon. It's amazing how quickly the tide turned, just when it seemed like the American forces couldn't do anything right. God was on their side. And as for the British, they had the momentum. They were willing to go. Their lead commander wasn't. It's one thing to be ready to go, but when your lead commander isn't ready to go and calls off the expedition, calls off the halt right as it's about ready to, wouldn't say call off the halt, halt meaning to stop, but calls off the mission altogether right as it's about ready to go, you have to wonder Is the man that we're serving under truly a competent officer? Prevost, sadly, was a cautious commander. He wasn't just a cautious commander, he was too cautious of one. Well, history has shown that even the most cautious of commanders don't always make rash decisions, especially when the momentum is totally on their side. Well, I do know that we have a lot of ground to cover in this next episode, being the first of the two-part series with the repercussions between the United States and Great Britain with regards to treaty negotiations. Rather, it's more so about repercussions involving London and Ghent. Now, I know I may have given part of that away, but I'm sure many of you are wondering, where is Ghent located? Is it located somewhere in Europe? Why don't we find out? So here we go with our first lead-off question to the first of our two-part series between the repercussions of London and Ghent to the Battle of Lake Champlain, a brilliant and extraordinary victory. Where is the Flemish town of Ghent located? It's in the province of East Flanders per the nation of Belgium. In 1814, the town of Ghent was under the United Netherlands before becoming part of the independent nation known today as Belgium. Now, I will point out that before this podcast book topic series comes to an end, I will need to make it a priority to tell you all when, in fact, Belgium officially got its independence. Because it's easy sometimes for all of us to think that, well, in the year 1814, that the majority of European nations had gotten their independence. Well, I think it's fair to say that there were a handful of European nations in 1814 that were independent, like, you know, the United Kingdom, France, Spain. But we do forget that there was no Belgium in 1814. It's easy to forget something like that, and I have to be reminded of that myself. But anyways, yes, in 1814, the town of Ghent was under what was known as the United Netherlands before becoming part of the independent nation that we know today as Belgium. Now, when exactly in 1814 did peace talk discussions first begin taking place at the neutral site of the port town of Ghent? It happened August the 8th. That's when peace talk discussions first began taking place, was August the 8th. And why this is worth pointing out is because August 8th marked 2 weeks and 2 days prior to Britain's burning of Washington, D.C. So, you know, I'm sure some of you are wondering now, when did, say, the delegates for the United States come to Ghent? They actually arrived in late June or the start of July. So we have to be reminded that, okay, not everybody meets right away after arriving. You know, we do have to take into consideration that delegates need to have time to discuss their strategies within the inner circle, meaning their own group, before officially meeting with the opposing side. But yes, August 8th marked 2 weeks and 2 days prior to Britain's burning of Washington, D.C. And of course, for these delegates on the United States side who came to Ghent, they knew that obviously that things were not to their advantage. But little did they know that 2 weeks and 2 days later, that something terrible would happen on their own home soil, 3,000 miles across the ocean, and that British forces would take it upon themselves to burn the nation's capital. But of course, as unfortunate as it was that happened, we should also be reminded that that our own government did not, most notably under Secretary of War John Armstrong, he just did not want to face reality that Washington, D.C. was in fact a direct target. In his eyes, Washington, D.C. was the wilderness. I've said this many of times before. I'll say it again here. Yes, Washington, D.C. was a wilderness. Yes, there were no fences around the White House. Yes, there was no adequate security for the Capitol. But at the same time, if you're in the wilderness, you must do whatever it takes to better fortify your surroundings so that the chances could have been reduced. But did John Armstrong take those chances? No, he didn't. And look what happened. Washington was burnt. Every building was burnt with the exception of the patent office building. Of course, he did resign. He resigned in disgrace. But there again, little did the American delegation know when they arrived to Ghent and talks began, the first set of talks began 2 weeks and 2 days prior to Britain's burning of Washington, D.C. Little did these delegates know that that an event would take place that would have such catastrophic results that ultimately left many in America wondering for a brief period of time, will the United States exist come year's end? Will we still wake up to an American flag? It left many people just wondering about whether or not America would live to see another birthday, given that she had just turned 38 years old on July 4th of 1814. So when the delegates from both sides first convened with one another, it is definitely fair to say that progress itself was very far away in attaining, most notably with the American delegation. The U.S. delegation agreed not to even introduce President Madison's requests for ending British impressment of American sailors and crew, along with the proposal in getting Britain to turn over Canada to the United States. I think it's fair to say that for the U.S. delegation, they probably knew that requesting for that the request to end impressment altogether was just not even attainable. I mean, yes, if you're one of the American delegates, I'm sure you would have loved to have told one of the British delegates, please stop this heinous practice. Please stop taking our own men against their own will just because you all are in need of just because you all are trying to overcome shortages. You know, we could tell them that all we want until we were blue in the face, but do you think that the British would have listened? No. And I can tell you more about that here momentarily. The American delegation was already well aware that any foreign assistance, being that of an alliance, was out of the picture. When I think of foreign assistance early on in America's history, I think of the American Revolutionary War and how France came to the side of the United States following our victory against Britain at Saratoga Springs, New York, or what was referred to as Saratoga. Once Benjamin Franklin, whom was minister overseas to France, received this news, then the French were persuaded to join and they came to the realization that, hey, we can align ourselves with the Americans, not because of what they've been through, but how we got snubbed out of territory, most notably the Ohio Territory from the French and Indian War, which as a result of our defeat, we had to give over everything to the British that we had claimed in terms of our own personal land holdings. So, you know, times have changed. Here we are almost 40 years later. For the United States, we're on our own here. We don't have any foreign assistance, so it's out of the picture altogether. The British delegation began peace talk discussion by demanding an establishment of an Indian barrier state, which would get set up west of the Appalachian Mountains, only to be connected by the Ohio and Mississippi rivers, including the Great Lakes. this is a huge swath of territory that that the British are hoping to secure to ultimately meet their objective in establishing an Indian buffer or barrier state, thus basically meaning that if the British have it their way and can create this Indian barrier state, there will be no more, that the United States would no longer be allowed to expand further westward into the Northwest Territory or simply anywhere else westward within its own country. So as for both sides in terms of what they control land-wise in 1814 in the Northwest, the United States controlled all of Ohio and Indiana. Indiana is still a territory, given that Ohio is already a state, but the United States controls all of Ohio and Indiana, including Illinois south of Peoria, as well as the Detroit region of the Michigan Territory. As for the British and their Indian allies, they controlled all of the Michigan Territory north of Detroit, along with all of present-day Wisconsin. The U.S. delegates are opposed to a buffer state. Why are they opposed to the idea of establishing a buffer state? I know I mentioned something earlier about it. They are opposed. Another reason for why they're opposed to this buffer state proposition by the British is that the U.S. delegates advocated abiding by all provisions from the 1783 Paris Treaty and the 1794 Jay Treaty, which gave the United States full jurisdiction over Michigan, Wisconsin, and all points south. It's amazing how things can change over time and even over a short period of time, but given that you are fighting fighting against someone whom you had fought years before and gained your political independence from, now you're trying to fight against them once again, this time via economic independence and also the well-being of your nation in terms of ensuring that your nation, being the United States, still retains its status as an independent national sovereignty. Of course, you know, the United States in 1814, I don't know if I would say we're a third world nation. We might be on the line of getting to second world nation status, but we won't become a world superpower really until the very late 19th century, well after this conflict in terms of America's second war for independence ultimately comes to an end. I've mentioned obviously quite a bit about the commissioners on the United States side, and I'm sure many of you are wondering just exactly how many commissioners did the United States send overseas to Ghent? The answer is five. The five men whom were sent overseas to Ghent were as follows: John Quincy Adams, Henry Clay, James Bayard Sr., Jonathan Russell, and Albert Gallatin. I'll mention more about these men in terms of in-depth matters here momentarily. The one advantage that the commissioners have is that four out of the five were senior political leaders, with the exception of Jonathan Russell. But to have four out of five commissioners with senior political leadership is definitely a solid advantage. Now, as for the British, they have a three-man team delegation. The first being 57-year-old Lord James Gambier, a career naval officer and an ardent supporter of impressment. Isn't that great if you're on the side of the United States knowing that one of the delegates is a strong supporter of impressment? No, it's not. But that's what it is. Dr. William Adams, he had a significant expertise in maritime law. Then you have a 30-year-old who was the youngest member of Britain's three-man team, being Henry Goulburn. He served as Undersecretary for War in the Colonies. Hang tight here for just a moment. Five. Now, I know I just mentioned the number five earlier, which pertained to the number of commissioners that the United States sent overseas to Ghent. But it just so happens the number five is mentioned here again. Why the second time? Five onto itself represents the average number of weeks it took for news from North America to reach Europe. 5 weeks is the average number that for which it took for the news from, say, the United States or Canada to reach Europe. U.S. delegates are far more removed from posts like Washington, D.C., 3,000 miles across the ocean, whereas the British delegation had more outlets for requesting extra measures from London. You know, think about it, folks. The British delegation can get all kinds of outlets in terms of newsletters, information within, you know, days, like maybe say 2 to 3 days. But if you're a delegate with the United States and you need news that'll benefit your side, it's going to take at best a month. If sailing conditions are right along the waters, it's going to take a month at best. So I hate to say this, but yes, the United States is definitely at a disadvantage here. So it's going to make any means of negotiation, bargaining, or trying to compromise, it's going to make it very hard for the United States. The bigger question is, can this five-man team do everything there is to their position, to the best of their abilities, in trying to modify what they can so that the longer the talks take place, perhaps just ultimately, the United States can get some good words of encouragement in terms of breaking news that actually benefits them, given that within a few short weeks of time, we have learned, you know, from previous episodes where how the British had burned Washington in August of 1814, August 24th, only for 2 weeks and 3 days later for a sudden reversal to happen up north in Lake Champlain. So yes, if you are a U.S. delegate, you have to hope that you can do everything there is in your power to prolong the discussions to where eventually you will get news that can favor your advantage and then force the opposition to basically revise their negotiation strategies. So let's get to know the five-man team delegation a little bit better, given that we've already mentioned their names, but let's learn a little bit more about them. John Quincy Adams was the head lead person of the U.S. delegation. At age 47, he had extensive government experience by holding numerous diplomatic posts, including a recent stint in Russia. He is the son of John and Abigail Adams, whom are both still living, in 1814. I want to say John Adams would have been just shy of 80 years old. Abigail Adams would have been probably at least in her early 70s, I want to say, at best. We have Henry Clay, former Speaker of the House of Representatives, a leading proponent in going to war against England in 1812. Albert Gallatin, he is not a natural-born citizen of the United States, which would hence ultimately have made him a naturalized U.S. citizen. He was born in Switzerland. He served as Treasury Secretary in Thomas Jefferson's administration as well as that of James Madison's. He had strong connections in England, including most of Europe, and I think it would make practical sense given that he hailed from Europe. But yes, Albert Gallatin, of all of them, has some very strong connections in England, If anybody else does, it probably would be fair to say John Quincy Adams. And after all, John Quincy Adams's father, John Adams, was ambassador to England after the American Revolutionary War ended. He became ambassador to England. Matter of fact, he was ambassador of England at the same time that Thomas Jefferson was ambassador of France. Hang tight here for a moment. Busy day, to say the least, so got to stay hydrated. And if I'm not drinking water, I'm drinking tea. But either way, they're both good for you. So as for the other two individuals, James Bayard Sr. was a well-known lawyer and Federalist politician from Delaware. And as for Jonathan Russell, he is a politician from Rhode Island. For John Quincy Adams and Henry Clay, they were both very aggressive and stubborn men whom were extremely opinionated. Albert Gallatin was the man who modified gaps within the delegation. Despite their flaws, the five-man team sought to favor unity in the midst of what they faced lying ahead. Well, I'm almost wondering if for this five-man team that the mission before them, this would sound crazy to say, but I think it's got some merit behind it. What they are going to be faced with in Ghent in terms of trying to come away with a favorable resolution or solution that will, you know, keep the United States intact as a nation. But I think it's fair to say that the mission before them is one of victory or death. Because if they don't come away with enough advantages to their side, how can they come back to America and assure President Madison and his administration that our nation as an independent sovereign nation has a future? So, you know, it's one thing to sign a treaty and assume that, well, everybody walks away happy with what they get, but history has probably had to show and remind us that when treaties take place, it's not always a case of everybody living happily ever after, but it's, you know, in the case here at the United States, it's really more about your survival long-term as a nation. Come August 8th of 1814, what issues were authorized by the British three-man delegation to discuss? Or I should say, by the British three-man delegation team to discuss? The British three-man delegation team was authorized to discuss four issues, ranging from impressment, Indians, including their borders, the Canadian border, to the right of Americans being allowed to fish and dry their catches along Canadian waters, shores. This is a lot. I mean, this is a lot, not only so much for the British delegation to address, but also for the Americans to take in. So the American delegation requested to hold off on responding until the following day, but advised British delegates they had orders on issues of impressment and Canadian border, but nothing on Indians nor fisheries. Once conversation resumed, the British delegation explained what their government's purpose was behind establishing an Indian nation between Canada and the United States within Northwest Territory. But the American commissioners were totally opposed to discuss this matter. I can't blame them, because if they are going to discuss this matter, for one, they would know that anything they say can and would be used against them. But two, they also know that whatever they spoke out in terms of opposing the matter with establishing an Indian nation between Canada and the United States, that the British would not only refuse to back down, but they would be a little too stubborn on their end to even want to come up with a modified solution Of course, if you're the Americans, I don't know if you even would want a modified solution, but the bottom line is that as of right now, this matter is off the books in terms of not discussing. But what I did find interesting when I read this book and doing research about the Treaty of Ghent was that even well before the War of 1812's beginning, even well before the United States Congress declared war on Britain come June 18th of 1812, the British themselves had always sought strategies behind creating a buffer or barrier state aimed at curtailing American expansion westward. Well, it's fair to say that that all goes back to the end of the French and Indian War. The irony, though, to it was that during the French and the Indian War, the British government had told those landholders whom had stakes in territory west of the Appalachians, most notably in Ohio, present-day Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, present-day West Virginia, that you would be able to settle further west once this war comes to an end, and we'll see to it that you are immune from any attacks by Indians. Wow, the British government officials really shot themselves in the foot. They may have emerged as a stronger superpower, but they reneged on their promise. They basically said, well, at this time, we're not going to allow any expansion westward of the west of the Appalachians. We have to give this land to the Indians. We had to make a deal with them to ensure that if we were going to be, if given that we are taking over territory that was once owned by the French, now it's in our possession, we have to cater to their interests. So you say one thing and then you do another, and then when the other party gets cheated out of something, then no wonder they're going to be upset. So the bottom line is that prior to the War of 1812's beginning, yes, the British may have always sought strategies behind creating a buffer or barrier state aimed at curtailing American expansion westward, but it is fair to say that since the French and Indian War, nearly 50 years later, Americans still feel the sting. We may be our own independent nation, but knowing that that a formidable foe that we know very well is still on our own soil trying to create havoc and trying to make life miserable for us simply has not gone away. And by doing so, they will go to whatever extremes they can to achieve their objectives just to halt our progress as a young, independent nation. John Quincy Adams did his homework here big time, and based upon what he viewed with regards to what the British were wanting to do in creating a buffer or barrier state, John Quincy Adams stated, or expressed, I should say, that there simply were not any guidelines for allowing Indian nations into peace treaties involving two nations. All right, well, if it involves two nations, we can also refer to it as a bilateral treaty or a bilateral agreement. So, yes, John Quincy Adams has a very good point here that there were not any guidelines or precedents laid out previously that which stated that Indian nations could be allowed into peace treaties involving two nations, the United States, in this case, Great Britain. No guidelines or precedents also meant that the United States would get forced into turning over all independent claims regarding Indian territories, most notably under a foreign country like Britain. The Indian buffer state was to be seen by the British delegation as a protectorate. What is a protectorate? I didn't know what that term itself was until having done research on the Treaty of Ghent. But a protectorate basically means that a state itself is under protection by another state for defensive means against aggression. So in other words, if the British successfully achieve what they want to achieve by creating an Indian buffer state, then the protectorate, being the Indian buffer state, would receive protection by the British for all means of defensive measure, for all defensive measures and purposes against any outside aggression, hostilities being that of the United States on the United States' own home soil. The protectorate state is one that has local rulers versus not being directly controlled. So for those of you who did not know anything about what protectorate means, that's your 101 lesson. In regards to the Canadian border, what did Foreign Secretary Viscount Castlereagh, interesting last name there, Castlereagh, Castlereagh, advise his delegation team proposed towards the U.S. commissioners? Castlereagh requested British delegates speak up about revising the Canadian border, which meant demanding Americans giving up or letting go of Fort Niagara and Sackett's Harbor, New York. Fort Niagara being on right near Lake Erie. Actually, I take it back, Lake Ontario. I should know that because when my wife and I went to Niagara Falls 6 years ago, we spent a day at Fort Niagara, and that's very well worth doing, and that is on Lake Ontario, just like Sackett's Harbor is. The British delegates also were told to request, or I should say, ask American surrendering of land in Maine, thus allowing Britain to proceed with building a road from Quebec to Halifax, Nova Scotia, including seeking access of land from the west, giving Canadian access to the upper Mississippi River. Man, these requests seem to have no boundaries. And if you're on the United States side, yes, you have taken a bold stand against expressing your opposition towards the British creating an Indian buffer state. But now all of a sudden you're getting another dosage where a barrage of requests that not only have no boundaries in sight, but now you have to wonder, okay, if the British have asked us to surrender all the land in Maine just so that they can proceed with building a road from Quebec to Halifax, Nova Scotia, on top of letting go of Fort Niagara and Sackett's Harbor, New York. What do we have? What will we have? A little tongue twister there, folks. What would we have in return to match what the British have offered? You know, when one side proposes something to the other, there's no guarantee that the other side can match that proposal. It's like playing a game of chess, or like playing a game of dice, most notably chess, in terms of trying to outsmart your opponent on a level basis. Castlereagh's instructions also entailed prohibiting the United States from possessing, and I kid you not, folks, any fortifications or naval forces along all five Great Lakes. So in other words, Foreign Secretary Viscount Castlereagh does not want the United States to possess any fortifications or naval forces along Superior, Huron, Michigan, Erie, Ontario. Of course, little does he know that Lake Michigan, as we know, does not even touch Canada. It's the only one of the five Great Lakes that does not border Canada. But yet the other four do. Yes, Lake Michigan does not border Canada, the only one of the five Great Lakes that doesn't, but here the other four do. Now you have to wonder, where do the lines end in terms of who can control what end, who gets the right to control the other, but who gets the right to have X, Y, and Z? Come August 19th, how did British delegates present to their counterparts, the U.S. delegation team, the matter pertaining to Indian buffer state? They issued a what is called sine qua non. I know that sounds crazy in terms of the term I just mentioned. I didn't know anything about this phrase until having, you know, done the necessary research. But sine, S-I-N-E, qua, Q-U-A, non, N-O-N, what that basically means, folks, it's an essential action or condition behind obtaining something per proposal requested. Okay, in this case, the British proposal requested is in regards to securing full access behind establishing an Indian nation, thus blocking the United States from westward expansion via the Northwest Territory. So sine qua non is basically an essential action or condition behind obtaining something. The U.S. delegate Albert Gallatin spoke out by requesting to know what would happen to nearly 100,000 Americans whom resided along the borders per Britain's proposed Indian buffer state. Hey, if I'm in Albert Gallatin's shoes, I would definitely be asking this question. You know, what's going to happen to the nearly 100,000 Americans whom reside along the borders? Well, British delegate Dr. William Adams told Gallatin that those people living along the current borders would have to simply fend for themselves by simply moving elsewhere. Okay, well, it's not like we could just call up a U-Haul moving company and say, hey, can you come help us move the stuff out of our homes along the prairie or homes along these rural settings? And we don't have that kind of transportation. You know, we might have a horse and buggy at best. And if we have that, that's good. But the bottom line is 100,000 Americans whom reside along the borders per Britain's proposed Indian buffer state, their national security is also at stake. I mean, it's not just so much America as a nation with regards to national security being at stake, but for those living along the borders. When I think of, you know, borders, you know, we could think of, like, say, Kentucky and Indiana, Kentucky, Ohio. We think of present-day West Virginia in Ohio. We have to remember, folks, that there is no such thing as West Virginia in 1814. The West Virginia that we know of today is still part of Virginia. Then we have people living in the Michigan Territory in Detroit, that is now back in American hands, bordering Ohio. So nobody really is safe, regardless of where you live along the borderline. But Albert Gallatin has certainly made it clear that, hey, what's going to happen to those roughly 100,000 Americans residing along the borders? And of course, Dr. William Adams can say is that those people living along the borders would simply have to fend for themselves by moving elsewhere, most notably east of the Northwest Territory. American situation is simply seen as one that's very dire. It's not good. There's little signs of hope. Well, it's like that saying, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. And I think it's fair to say that the five-man delegation team knows that that if they surrender now and don't continuously stand up for themselves, then they will have shown nothing and ultimately have let their country down. How did the U.S. delegation move forward despite their opposition towards Britain's proposals? All five delegates unanimously agreed to send all written British proposals or requests directly to the United States. And yes, this could take 5 weeks or a little bit more. But there's a reason why they're sending all these written proposals directly to the United States. The American response via written document would explain how Britain's demands were beyond unacceptable. Most notably, requests involving a proposal to abandon territory and ask a fraction of their people to accept a foreign nation's presence regarding all domestic matters. In other words, we don't need to have a foreign nation be sticking their nose in all of our domestic matters when they don't even own us anymore. And yet they're still trying to do something that they know in our eyes is not acceptable, but yet they are not willing to go down without a fight. The U.S. letter also included their proposing solution behind requesting to end all outstanding hostilities between both sides, thus meaning each side could and ought to surrender any territory previously acquired. What mistake? I like this one here, because just when it seems like the British delegation is unstoppable, even when you're unstoppable and you don't recognize your boundaries, you are bound to make a mistake that can come back and get you. What mistake, not known by the U.S. delegation team, had the British delegation made? For starters, Britain's three-man team went beyond what was originally advised per Viscount Castlereagh's orders. Castlereagh himself never, get this folks, Viscount Castlereagh never himself encouraged nor promoted the idea behind creating an Indian buffer state. This man never encouraged nor promoted his delegation to permanently establish an Indian buffer state. But the irony to it all is that if an Indian buffer state was to be established, it would only be for specific or certain guarantee requests regarding future security concerns for all of Britain's Indian allies. So in other words, you might have a buffer state for a year. At minimum, you could have it for, say, maybe 3 years, depending on how severe the conflict itself was, but never would we flat out say that if I'm Viscount Castlereagh, never would I have said, well, it's going to be this way for the next 30 years. Well, it makes good sense because, you know, a lot of things change over time, and what might be good for today may not be no longer needed 5 to 10 years from now. So the British three-man team got caught up in the moment and basically said to the U.S. delegation team that, hey, look, this Indian buffer state, this is going to be a permanent fixture. No, they should not have done that. But there again, they allowed their emotions and their dominance to get the better of them. Now, when the American delegation declined or opposed a British stance on any proposed matter, the British team relied on referring outside matters to London for final decision or advice. Early September 1814 saw officials in London still awaiting on the news regarding the Chesapeake Bay attacks, Lake Ontario, the Maine coast, and Lake Champlain. British proposals at present moment viewed the current war simply as one of conquest against the United States. Instead of the opposite, many of us probably were led to believe that the current war was to have been viewed as one to protect Canada, but that wasn't the case. The current war was viewed as really a conquest against the United States and ultimately bringing the United States down as a nation to where her existence would no longer be relevant. Britain sought to extend talks while awaiting military results. Well, I think it's probably fair to say they may not really have much of a choice. Well, you know, Britain's on a high roll. You know, it seems like nothing has been able to stop them. They've got so much momentum on their side. But what reverse course of action had the British engaged in starting from early September into mid-October 1814? The British backed away from earlier demands pertaining to creation of an Indian buffer state, as well as wanting removal of all U.S. forts and naval vessels along the Great Lakes. That's quite a radical withdrawal, to say the least, in terms of backing away from previous demands that would have pertained to creating an Indian buffer state, as well as wanting removal of all U.S. forts and naval vessels along the Great Lakes. The British delegation received a note on September 16th, which stated to drop the full request for entire control of all five Great Lakes. The letter also advised that the Indians were to be included in the final treaty, but nothing mentioned within the letter behind establishing a buffer state. It's amazing how quickly things can change. But there again, the United States, per their delegation team, has made it clear that they're not going to back down without a fight. And they have certainly done just that. The U.S. team proposed an offer by issuing an amnesty. I'm sure most of you all know what an amnesty is, but for those of you who aren't sure what an amnesty refers to, it means a mass pardoning. I do know of a good example in history where after the Civil War had ended, it didn't happen overnight, the United States Civil War, an amnesty was eventually issued towards all of those soldiers who fought for the Confederacy, to where they took oaths of allegiance to re-swear their allegiance to the United States as one nation. So that's an example there of where an amnesty was given, a mass pardon. Another good example of when an amnesty did take place, it was during the Vietnam War. There were many many of our young men whom did not want to go to war on the grounds that that they just didn't believe that the cause was right. Many of them ended up going to Canada, so this way they would avoid having to be drafted into war. But over time, they were given an amnesty, a mass pardon for having engaged in actions that at one time the government thought was unjustified, but knowing the circumstances that they were faced with, government officials came to their senses and realized that perhaps it would be best to give all of those men whom had refused to fight at one time an amnesty, a mass pardon. So yes, the United States team had proposed an offer by issuing an amnesty, being a mass pardon for all Indians whom fought alongside Britain. I don't think that's a bad proposal either, too. Maybe it's their way of trying to somehow woo those Indians over to the American side, and then they would be forgiven of any previous crimes they may have committed in terms of taking up loyalties with the wrong side. September of 1814, word got to Ghent, where 2 months earlier in July, the United States government and various Indian tribes within the Northwest Territory signed a peace treaty known as the Treaty of Greenville. There was a Treaty of Greenville from 1795, but another Treaty of Greenville took place nearly 20 years later, being that in July of 1814. The treaty took place on July 22nd of that year. The treaty involved the tribes of the Wyandots, the Delawares, Shawnee, Seneca, and Miami. And for those of you who are curious to know where Greenville is, there are several places in the United States that are known as Greenville, named after American Revolutionary War officer Nathaniel Greene. Greenville, Ohio is north of Dayton. And this is where the treaty took place in 1814, as well as for the one in 1795, when Ohio was, back in the day, when Ohio was considered Ohio Territory. So the treaty was signed, which on July 22nd, 1814, it included establishing an alliance between the United States and these five tribal nations against Britain during the ongoing war. The treaty called for the Indian tribes under the agreement to give aid to the United States and not make any attempts to direct an independent peace, along with having all tribes admit themselves under U.S. protection and not any other nation like that of Britain. The United States, on their end, agreed to respect Indian boundaries within those Indian nations prior to war having begun. The United States really has scored a big victory here, folks. The U.S.-Indian Treaty at Greenville curtailed London's existing allegiance with Indians, thus removing the need for them to be part of the final peace agreements. I'll tell you, this first part of our two-part series on the repercussions of London and Ghent has seen its fair share of roller coasters, but I think it's fair to say that when I'm on the air again next, whatever share of roller coasters we will be learning about might be greater than the ones that we've talked about just now. Well, thank you for your time as always, and I look forward to being back on the air again next time. And wherever you all may live, continue to stay safe.